So, Tom, I'm going to put my first question to you. Andrew Carnegie made a fortune busting unions and then gave it all back through grand philanthropies. This has been described as, quote, the basic rape, pillage, and philanthropy model of business. Carnegie has, of course, given millions and established institutions that bear his name, such as Carnegie Mellon University, Carnegie Hall, Carnegie Endowment for Peace. So what's wrong with that model?
Well, thank you. I'm glad that some of the early American pioneers were not all of that same persuasion, but in fact had a sense that business was family enterprise, a community enterprise, something good for the country, and it wasn't all about, sales and profits. And I think probably by the time I was a young person, businesses to me seemed to be wrapped up in technology, and I remember my parents being so excited about what they could get for new appliances, and it was the age of technology, and these were the same companies that were polluting the rivers in our neighborhood, and I had a question. I was not the only one that questioned those things. So I think for myself, I grew up in Western Massachusetts, in the Berkshires. I was used to a beautiful environment. I was used to people caring for their place. I was used to family businesses because my father had his own business, and it all seemed to me to be incongruent that we would be seeing lakes and streams polluted with phosphates and the numbers of things that improved the performance of laundry detergents, and if it wasn't phosphates, it was tanning chemicals that would end up near tanneries. There were no breaks to the system of sort of celebrating what business could do for our lives. So I was very much a typical student of the 60s, and we were born to question everything. And I just realized, having grown up in a household in which business was the norm, that you could do things that were good for the customer, good for the world, and good for yourself at the same time. And that's the model that Kate and I adopted when we founded Toms of Maine, and we never changed course, that there, we could have commonly shared values, mutual values that were good for society, good for the earth, good for the customer, and good for us. So we simply had a different point of view, and I knew that a business didn't have to be all driven by profits, that it was the agents of business that determined whether a company was good or bad in the opinion of the rest of us. And so it was really a question of what values you had and what decisions you made that were aligned with those values. So I don't think we need to make our money as crass business people and then go out and give it away to look good.
Jeffrey, last weekend you were at the People's Climate March in New York City. I was there too. It was amazing. I saw the photos of you and your family on your website. So one of the people who I heard speak when I was there was Naomi Klein, the activist and the author who's got a new book out called This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. She argues that the free market and unfettered capitalism is the key driver of climate change, and that business succeeds because of consumption, and consumption is killing the earth. So you've built a career on getting people to consume things. How do you reconcile that with the idea that if we're to survive, we need to consume less stuff?
Well, first of all, I agree with her that we need to consume less stuff. And we need to consume differently than we have in the past. I probably wouldn't go so far as to say that we need to get rid of capitalism, but I would certainly say that we need to get rid of the way in which we practice capitalism today. Capitalism is not one structure. There's lots of different ways in which you can practice capitalism, and I think the way that we practice it today is dangerous, destructive, and has put us as a human race in a very dangerous and precarious situation. You know, I am a board member of Greenpeace, so I share her concern that climate change may be the defining issue of our time. And it's amazing to me that given the science, businesses of all sorts, responsible, sustainable, as well as traditional, have generally failed to respond adequately to the challenge that we face. Although we have to understand that that is in a context of an economic system that basically encourages us to do the wrong things. So we have created an economy through subsidies and taxes and regulations that basically encourage consumers to purchase the things that are going to be the most damaging for themselves and the environment by usually carrying a lower price tag. And if you want to be responsible and you want to avoid or internalize those negative impacts, you end up with a more expensive product. And I think, you know, what we need to do is we need to think about what ways in which can we radically change this economy so that not only does it reflect the kind of values that Tom is talking about, but businesses are incentivized to do the right thing rather than the wrong thing. And so we need to have things like full cost accounting. We need to not make products that hurt the environment cheaper because the costs of the destruction to the environment are externalized onto society. If we force business to internalize those negative costs, those bad products will become very expensive. If we take a organic strawberry versus a traditional strawberry, if the traditional strawberry had to, not the strawberry itself, of course, but the strawberry farmer, had to pay to clean up the groundwater that was polluted by pesticides, had to pay the incremental health care costs of their workers for the health impacts of working around those pesticides, and had to pay the communities where those pesticides drifted and the health impacts of that, it would be far too expensive for anyone to buy a traditional strawberry, and by comparison, the organic strawberry would be much less expensive. Well, we, instead of doing that, create the inexpensive pesticide-laden strawberry, which most people want to buy, and some people can't afford to do anything else than that. So it is, you know, we have designed an economy that has had all of the negative effects that we are so upset about. And to fix that, I think we have to fundamentally change the way that economy is designed.
So what does this kinder capitalism, or whatever you would call it, what does it look like? And how does it address the other major fallout of capitalism, which is inequality?
Yeah. And first of all, we shouldn't separate those two things, because the absence of sustainability and the incredible inequality of our society, I mean, the fact that 1% of America owns 50% of the wealth, some people have said that the Walmart family alone own almost 30% of the wealth in the United States. The fact that there are millions of children who are homeless in this country. The fact that 1 out of 6 people in America live on food stamps, you know, is not something to be proud of. And the very issues that cause that incredible wealth inequality are the same structural issues that we have designed into an economy that has such a negative toll on the environment. How we change that is the subject of a book, not a few words. But what I would say is that we need to look at the systemic issues. So we need organizations like VBSR and the American Sustainable Business Council that are working to change the rules of the game. It's nice that Tom and I can be exceptions to the rules, but at the end of the day, you got to change the rules if you're going to really have a lasting impact. We also, I think, have to fundamentally change what our aspirations are. I mean, one of the biggest challenges that I have with responsible businesses is that in most cases, it's about being less bad. It's about less pollution, using less water, using safer chemicals. And what we really need is we need businesses that are regenerative, that are actually going to repair the earth and the planet and have a positive impact rather than a less negative impact. So, you know, one of the reasons, you know, a lot of people would say, why did you get into the condom business? Well, aside from the fact that sex is better than, you know, selling toilet paper, I mean, there's no question about that. And it's just more entertaining to be in business selling condoms. I chose condoms very deliberately because condoms are an example of a product that can actually have a positive effect on the planet, and a much more positive than negative. Because we use fair trade latex, we are providing better employment and wages for our workers. Because we have a sustainable plantation, we're using less pesticides. Less people equals less climate change. So we were aspiring to create a model of what was called a net positive business rather than a less bad business.
I think Jeff has identified some very important problems that we have, and I'd like to add one, and that is us, consumers. We've done this to ourselves. We've done this to ourselves. When Walmart says we sell for less, that's because we want to pay less. And that's what the business model responds to, is a price point, a target audience that's big enough to make it an appealing risk to take on. And the lower the price point for the commodity, hopefully the bigger the category is for that, and we want our share of that category. Jeffrey and I have been living in a premium world where we do pay the price for the better way, whether it's organic or natural or recyclable or sustainable. Those are all normal words in our business model and in our culture within our individual business cultures. And the reason we do that is to demonstrate that it can be done, that you can treat people differently to motivate them, that you can construct a product out of renewable, recyclable, natural, whatever that choice is, that is a low impact on the environment. And then you have the problem of it's costing more than the commodity that was built altogether differently on cheaper materials. And so our price premium might be 50-60%. And so we need volume as small businesses to bring our costs down and so on. But I do think that I've targeted my products for people that can afford my products. You are our venture capitalists. You've been willing to pay more for toothpaste or a wool sweater because you believed in the principles of the company and the product. And it aligns with your personal values, and you had the money to buy it. Not everyone has the money to buy it. I've had two businesses that have intentionally gone targeted people who are discerning, smart, discerning, fit, but they also have money. And I need that person to pay the premium that I can't. And so as I take my new collection of fine wool, Pima cotton, things that are grown here in this country, made here by American manufacturers and so forth, and I present them to a retail store and they say, your wholesale prices are my retail prices for what I can get from China or elsewhere. And getting them off the addiction to low prices is very difficult for people that start these businesses and create the model that's different. But again, then you go for the places that have customers coming in that can afford that. Well, that means we end up with these wonderful models that are, you know, the specialties. But they are models. It shows that it can be done. I was presenting our collection to a women's boutique day before yesterday. And she said, oh my goodness, I'm so glad you're back, because 2 years ago she turned us down. She said, we're getting all kinds of pushback from our shoppers that the sweaters we have here are made in China. And they're just walking out. They're not buying them. And so they said, we're looking for a Made in America brand. You know.
So what was the tipping point moment that where suddenly the blowback of the Walmart mentality of you know, everything made at the cheapest possible sweatshop? What do you think has changed?
What is going to change, or what has changed?
What has changed to make this shop be interested in selling your product?
It's an informed consumer that is willing to practice their values, live by their values, and expect the product to hold up as a sustainable product, that it's going to last more than a season's fashion.
But if you look at the retail sector as a whole, who's winning right now? Dollar General, you know, Family Dollar. There's been very disappointing sales for the mid to higher price mainstream retailers, and the winners are the cheapest stores. And I don't think that that's because consumers don't care. I think that's because if you look at our economy and you look at how many people are unemployed or underemployed or even employed with a salary that ensures they remain in poverty, many of them can't afford anything else. And I think that we, you know, I would say one of the things that's different about Sustain is that our goal is to price at parity to Trojan, in part because as much as I like helping intelligent, wealthy people, I felt like, you know, I would rather help all the people that are, you know, less wealthy. It's hard to do with a good product, but I think it's possible to do. But again, you know, we've designed a system. I mean, if you create wages that ensure fully employed people live in poverty, you know, and need food stamps and can't take care of their kids and spend time with them, I mean, we've created a dysfunctional society by design. And you know, I think the question that we have to ask is, well, what role can business do about that? What can business do? And to what extent are they responsible? And I would say that businesses paying those wages are part of the problem. I would say that businesses that capture the value that they create and only give it to senior management and venture capitalists and private equity are accentuating this concentration in wealth. And we need to not just say, you know, it's the government, you know, that's why things aren't working. We have to look at the way business is designed and challenge business to play a more responsible role in society. I mean, you look at these so-called inversions where, you know, companies are leaving the United States to avoid paying taxes. I mean, what kind of moral environment do we live in where it's okay for a business to live in a community but not pay taxes, not contribute to the police force, the fire force, the schools, because they've based themselves in Ireland and they don't have to pay the taxes that a local department store or drugstore would pay. I don't know if you remember when Starbucks was complaining about people demonstrating outside its stores in England. And why were they demonstrating? Because Starbucks, in 10 years as a retailer in England, had paid no taxes. And, you know, the explanation was, well, if we don't make money, we don't pay taxes. And most people said, well, okay, you know, if you're not making money, you shouldn't pay taxes. What they didn't know was that the business was designed to lose money because the taxes are high in England. So Starbucks in the UK had given the license of its name to a company in Belgium. And so all the profits of all their UK businesses were sucked out of England, where the taxes were high, paid in royalties to their business in Belgium, where the taxes were low, and they got off perfectly legally not paying taxes. So, I mean, this is, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but the system has been designed to screw a lot of lower income people and the environment. I think that the time has passed in many ways for us to put Band-Aids on the problem. And I think that we have to really look at the root causes of the dysfunctions that we face in society and challenge ourselves and challenge businesses and challenge our elected representatives to deal with the consequences that we're all so unhappy about.
I guess I've lived long enough to become a cynic when it comes to politics. My father was a cynic about politics, and it made me very angry. I feel that settling in, and for good reason. For good reason. Why should we have to argue about whether or not someone should have a minimum wage that's livable? I would think we want the best for each other. I wouldn't think that we're trying to live in this selfish state of, let's be sure we get the most for ourselves. And so, Jeffrey, I'm not expecting government to change. Government hasn't done a damn thing since I was eligible to vote. It's amazing. All the hopes, all the money, all the talk, all the candidates, what in fact has actually been done for American people, for the environment, or even for business? If it weren't for people like Bill Gates and others that have used business and technology and the free enterprise system, we wouldn't have this strong America that we have. Certainly government didn't make it so for us. And so I come back to the question of where is the power? The power is still with the people, particularly consumers. The more we can empower you for choices, and I agree completely with Jeffrey, let's not make these choices so expensive that you don't have a choice. But I dare say that for every category of product that you buy today, there is probably a socially responsible candidate in there. And it probably is a local one. Local is becoming our way to gain power. And it shows. Just look at what we do for our communities when we are helping small local businesses. So I have to say that once again, I'm not waiting for Congress to fix this. I think we have to foster entrepreneurship, socially responsible businesses, and to provide education and information for consumers so they are empowered to make a choice that's better for them, better for the world, and better for that company.
What's the difference between what you say and what the Tea Party says? they're against government too.
Well, I think I'll just say that I'm sufficiently disgusted with all of politics that I won't comment on that.
Jeffrey, do you have a different view of what the role and potential for government might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Good, this is good. You might have more faith than I do.
As dysfunctional as government is, and I think that's primarily because of the way money is used in politics, and I question whether we actually live in a democracy anymore,
right?
Because the democratic will of the people is hard to find. Most politicians don't act out of the best interests of the people that elected them. They act out of the best interests of the people who contributed the most to their campaign. And so I'm not sure we still have a democracy, but I have hopes that we can once again have one. And I think the challenge we face is how bad will things get before they get better? How bad will things get from a social perspective in terms of social inequity? How many homeless children do we need in America? How bad do things need to get from an environmental perspective? How frequent and bad do storms like Hurricane Sandy need to be before we recognize that there really is something wrong? So I think that we need a government to, if that government is acting in the best interests of the people that it represents, but that bears no relationship to the government that we have today. It's a challenging time to be much of an optimist. I would say, thankfully, we have a new generation of people who are in their, teens and 20s and, who I see great signs that they find the situation that we have handed to them to be one that is not acceptable. And I am hoping that they have the will and commitment to clean up this incredible mess that we have left to them. As easy as it is to be cynical and hopeless, I fear that that hopelessness helps ensure a bad outcome. But it's a struggle. I mean, I am always looking for things to be hopeful about, and it's a challenging place for us to be.
Well, that's a good opportunity then to talk about sex and what you're doing now. So,
can you understand why I switched to sex? I mean,
it's exactly what I could you just bring us into the room when around your kitchen table, who proposed to who that dad and daughter go into business selling condoms? Yeah. Was there an awkward moment there?
No, there was no awkward moment. I mean, I must say, I was quite cautious about luring my daughter into the condom business because I thought this could go bad so many ways. So I was really cautious, but I think in the end, the reason my daughter wanted to be in business with me was because she looked at the statistics. She looked at the fact that, 25% of first-year college students end up with some type of STD. She looked at how embarrassed her peers were about buying condoms. You know, here it is, this thing you should be proud of because you're making sure that you're not having an unintended pregnancy. You're making sure that you don't get an STD. I mean, you're taking care of your health. And instead of being able to feel good and celebrate that, women, by and large part, are embarrassed. And, if you go buy vitamins, you feel good. If you go exercise, you feel good. If you go eat organic food, you feel good. But if you go buy condoms, you sort of don't want to be standing in front of that condom aisle too long because of how other people will view you. And so for her, she had a real passion for helping change the attitude of her peers so that they wouldn't subject themselves to all of the bad things that happen if you don't take care of your sexual health. And when I saw that passion in her, I felt encouraged that I could play a role in helping her fulfill the positive impact that she wanted to have. And it was, I felt sort of honored and lucky that somehow I had played a role in creating a child that wanted to do this. So now, when people overhear our family at restaurants, that can be problematic. They don't know, you know, sometimes they think she's my girlfriend. I mean, they don't, you know, they just, it can be very, very confusing. And I remember, and this is the last story I'll tell, is when I was going out to raise money for the business, it was amazing to me how uncomfortable some investors were about a father and daughter condom business. Because many of these investors, when I said, well, you know, what does your daughter use for birth control? And most of these guys, not women, had no idea. And I said, would you ever talk to your daughter about birth control? Well, no, my wife does that, or the doctor does that. And I said, that's why you need to invest in this business, because that's a bad situation, that you have no idea what your daughter is doing to take care of her sexual health. It wasn't a persuasive argument, because that's not the way people make investment decisions. But we live in an ungodly Byzantine, repressive society when it comes to sex. I always thought that I was sort of an outlaw and a revolutionary for a lot of reasons, but I never imagined that one of them would be because I was encouraging people to use condoms.
So now, in all seriousness, you're trying to do some new things here. You're trying to sell condoms for women, which is almost, sell condoms to women, which has almost never been done. This is a $1 billion-a-year business, I think. And you're trying to break in through, you're a tiny little player in that. How do you create space as a small player to do what you want to do? And I know that you're also giving 10% to, well, you explain some of these things.
Yeah, we are a stepchild of 1% for the planet, because we started 10% for women. So 10% of the profits go to women's reproductive health care. But we, you know, I'm a little bit of a guerrilla fighter. And so one of the things we learned when we were going into the condom business, thankfully the German government, of all the governments in the world, had actually tested condoms to see whether there were any bad chemicals in them. And lo and behold, the German government 2 years ago found that 29 out of 32 condoms they tested had carcinogenic chemicals in the condoms. You know, just how could you produce a condom with carcinogenic chemicals in it? So we were able to design a manufacturing process that was free of any detectable carcinogens. And my wife and I funded a study that was published on Friday that analyzed all of the condoms sold in the United States. And what did they find? That all of the condom brands sold in the United States, except for two, Lifestyles and Sustain, had carcinogenic chemicals in them. And we hope that that will be a bit of a wake-up call. We hope that that will highlight how we do business differently. It's a double-edged sword, because we don't want people to stop using condoms, but we want them to be more thoughtful in choosing condoms that weren't made by children and didn't have carcinogenic chemicals in them. And it's met with a pretty voracious attack from people like Trojan, who had terrible amounts of carcinogens in their condoms. You know, their answer is the FDA has determined that Trojans are safe for decades, and, you know, who is this guy to come and question the standards that the government has set for safe products? You know, I think that by focusing on women, by focusing on safe manufacturing processes, by focusing on who really wants to use a condom that was made by a 12-year-old child that should be in school? We will carve out market share. Because the truth is, especially if you can take the premium out of the price, and then the choice that the consumer has is, do I want carcinogens or no carcinogens? Do I want child labor or no child labor? I think that we can sell a few condoms. But you know what? If we don't, we'll have had fun trying.
All right. Let me switch gears a little bit here. And Tom, your story is remarkable and probably has some very interesting follow-up tales. So you and your wife, Kate, who's here with you, started Toms of Maine in 1970 with a $5,000 loan. By the 2000s, you had helped launch a $4.5 billion natural personal care industry. And in 2006, you sold the company to Colgate-Palmolive for $100 million. But Colgate would seem to be a strange parent for Toms. It has been, in recent years here, in a fight with the FDA, which wants to restrict the use of triclosan and Colgate toothpaste. So what is it, how did you weigh that? You had built this baby, Toms of Maine, into a, you know, really a symbol of all that is good, and you got taken over, or you sold to a company that is not associated with that notion.
Well, thank you for asking the question. Reached a point in the business that we simply felt that we couldn't take it further and that we needed to have the kind of capital and leverage that was not possible with the size of the organization that we were. And also, I was tired. These things have their toll, and you keep on forecasting and keep on trying to make gains, and obviously we did. But these we're called pioneers here for a reason. They take a lot of doing and a lot of energy, and so for myself, I didn't want to put the company up for sale. Our family decided that, yeah, okay, let's find a home for this business. Our board of directors, which consisted of people who are very astute business people and deans of business schools, were certainly wise in the ways of selling businesses. And we decided as a board of directors, a board and a family, that we would not put the company up for sale. We would go out and see if we could find a partner that we thought would represent the kind of values and be able to magnify the business opportunity that we had created. And so we identified five companies, and I contacted the CEO personally of all of those five companies and asked whether or not they would be interested in talking about a strategic partnership. Strategic meaning that they were in the business of oral care or personal care, and that we were going to take advantage of their strengths and so forth. And in fact, Colgate wasn't on that list because I had had sort of a head-to-head with them earlier on. And yet the more I learned about Colgate and talked with people that I trusted, the more I said, oh, fine, no harm, let's put them on the list. Well, as the process played out, it was amazing to me that Colgate probably showed the most enthusiasm and the most interest in our values and our difference. They had experiences in acquisitions before and were very cautious not to sort of Colgate-ize Toms of Maine. And so that was their point of view. These were intelligent people. These were people that we grew to like. And then when they said, would you be interested in knowing what our corporate values are? And we said, sure. And they were caring, number one, teamwork, number two, and continuous improvement, number three. And I thought to myself, well, gee, if this is true, this is a pretty good fit. And one thing led to another, and we really found that they were very interested in what we had created and didn't want to wreck it, and wanted to see the management of Toms of Maine continue, for Kate and I to continue, which we did. And it's been just an amazingly healthy relationship. They defer to Kate and me about what to do at certain junctures of Toms of Maine. Our people are still running the place. My COO, Tom O'Brien, is now the CEO. Everything that is normally done to kind of ruin these small companies has been avoided. Now, then you have this thing that sticks out there that is controversial, and that's been controversial for a long time. And for me, I just sort of say, well, they've got to work that out. That's not a Toms of Maine issue. They've got to work that out. But we do know these people as human beings and as business people, and they are really smart business people. I think we made a tremendous decision, and our people feel that way. And they're doing a great job with the brand. So it wasn't sort of put it up for sale, who's going to pay the highest price. Our board said, let's be sure the values are honored, let's be sure we get a fair price, and let's be sure they don't mess up the naturalness of this brand. And, you know, I was really proud of my board of directors that they would stand up and not take the highest price, but look for the right fit and the right strategic partner. So whatever Colgate has for an issue with an ingredient, I'm going to let them work that out. But in the meantime, I know them, and I know them to be very bright, responsible, and very smart business people. So I'm really, really proud that we're there. I just wanted to make a point that Jeffrey was talking about when he said he was on the board of Greenpeace. And this is one of the hopes. And when I say I'm a cynic of politics. I'm not a cynic, period. I'm a very hopeful person. And my hope is in people and small business, entrepreneurship, local. And then the NGOs. You know, Greenpeace has gone after these global apparel companies. I exist as an apparel company because these global apparel companies are insensitive to what is being done in the cut and sew operations in Bangladesh. They're insensitive to the chemicals that are used in the rivers and the streams. And so Greenpeace, I mean, blew me away, said, okay, we're coming up with a manifesto to clean up the toxic wastes of the apparel industry. And I thought that was just fabulous. And I became a co-signer of that manifesto. I don't care what retail partners think of me that I'm signing on to Greenpeace. I don't care what anybody thinks. They've got their finger on the right issue, and they're doing something about it, and they've raised it up. So if you want to have an impact, help these NGOs. They're on the right track. Greenpeace is doing a great job.
Jeffrey, your experience with the company that you founded, you had tried to be very careful to make sure that the investors that you brought into Seventh Generation wouldn't undermine your vision for using the company to change the nature of the business. But I'm guessing you feel that you didn't quite succeed in that, that the company that you founded and led for 20 years, you ended up being forced out of the company.
You're being polite.
Okay. Well, I'll let you take it from there. I'm sure this was very painful. So what did you learn from that, and how are you going to prevent it from happening again?
No one likes to get fired from a company they started and worked at for 23 years. And it was a extremely painful and just sad experience. But as I reflected on that, you know, I have to take most of the responsibility because I'm the one who put those people on the board. I'm the one that took their money. And if I didn't do enough due diligence on their values and their beliefs and their historical practices, you know, that's my fault. I mean, the reality is that I had sold the majority of the company to outside investors and had given up formal control of the business. I think as time has passed, while there are many things that the board and I disagreed on, those things largely haven't made Seventh Generation into a bad brand. I just think that my sense of how to run a business is just very different from theirs. And we differed over fundamental issues like employee ownership, where you know, my goal was to get the company to become an ESOP that was owned primarily by the employees. And, you know, the truth is that the investors really didn't want to see their return on their investment watered down by the shares that were given to the employees. And if I had done a little bit of research into these people before I got into bed with them, I probably would have been able to figure that out, but I didn't do that. And it, you know, it certainly has led to me creating a very different kind of business today, where it is a family business, where my family perpetually controls the majority of the board, where the employees elect one board member out of seven, and the investors have two seats out of seven on the board. And if they don't like that, they cannot invest in the company. But I knew that I had to structurally design a company that was going to, in perpetuity, express our values. And, you know, we do that also by being a legal B corporation and by taking
Explain
on...
Explain what that means for people who don't know.
Yeah, so if you don't know what a B corporation is, I mean... We live in a, I always like to tell this joke, you know, for a moment, and it will only be a moment, I'm going to make all of you the CEOs of the Fortune 500. And I'm going to ask you a very simple question. Do you run a responsible business? So how many hands are going to go up? 500, right? Is anybody in the Fortune 500 going to say they're not running a responsible business? Well, thankfully, the B Corporation process is the only effective way that I know of that sort of separates out the real responsible businesses from the people that just want to raise their hand. So it imposes on you some legal requirements and reporting requirements that, to my mind, are the best way in which I, as a consumer, can actually know that this is a more responsible business than the other 99% that are out there. So I go back to this question of design. You know, just the way we designed the economy to have the effects that it has on inequality, and we designed the economy to have the impacts it has on the environment, you have to design the structure of your business from a governance perspective to have the wherewithal to ensure that it stays on the path that you want it to be on. I did not do that at Seventh Generation. I think I've done that at Sustain. And, you know, there's only one downside to it. I mean, I thought it was bad sometimes to work for this board of private equity, hedge fund, and venture capitalists. Some days working for my wife and my daughter can feel equally challenging, because I am bossed around more today than I've ever been bossed around in my life. But at least I'm bossed around by people who I know love me. And that, it makes a real difference. And there's a certain joy that comes from working so closely with people who you know that no matter what happens, no matter how bad things get, you can count on them to be looking out for your best interest. And so far, it's been a wonderful experience.
And you have this in common. For both of you, your second act, you also, the top people in your new venture, Rambler's Way, are your kids, right?
That's right, and that was deliberate. And I will say that the task of maintaining governance control as entrepreneurs, founding entrepreneurs, in the journey of building a business and needing capital and going out to attract capital, the challenge of maintaining more than 50% ownership is very, very difficult. And it puts a lot of stress on the whole organization. Kate and I owned more than 50% of Toms of Maine right up to the very moment that we made the decision to sell. And so that kind of control is really important. In the case of our new business, we had the choice of being a philanthropist full-time, playing golf, joining 5 boards. And as I am quick to tell people who ask me to join boards, I'm a terrible board member because I really go after the CEO. And so I don't have a life doing that. I'm a CEO of a business that I prefer to run, my own business. And I prefer to do that with a second generation that we've been trained, and these children have grown up around the table at Toms of Maine. We have, 3 of our children have their own businesses. My youngest son has a business in San Francisco called Luke's Local, and he's just humming with this wonderful growth business, local and organic food and farmers and so forth. And a daughter who has a therapeutic equine therapy business, helping 150 clients that use horses to begin to feel better, speak for the first time, become empowered because the horse is a healer. A son who has a restaurant that is one of the best restaurants in Maine in a very short period of time. A daughter who works with me as our designer in this new business. A son who works, runs our website and also is a musician, and a son-in-law who works with the supply chain, with the ranchers and the textile companies to take our fabrics from, fiber right to fabric and so forth. Very intentional. Let's go into business with the family and carry on a family-owned, family-controlled enterprise that has the values that we care about. So it's, for me, it's been an intention to pass on how you build this business model of doing well while doing good. And it's great fun. I mean, the culture at Rambler's Way works very, very hard. They're very smart. They love to solve problems. And, I do the thing that I love the most. I get out and sell.
I would say, in studying corporate responsibility, I have found that family businesses generally, not always, tend to be more responsible because they have this sense of legacy. And they have this sense that we're here to stay. And they tend to treat their workers and the environment better.
Absolutely.
Because it's not about being a CEO for 3 to 4 years and then going to another company. It's about doing this for my life and what I leave to my family and my children and the family and children of my workers. And in some ways, I wish we had more family businesses in the United States. There's some countries outside the United States that have a much greater tradition of family businesses than we have here.
And I think it's about that face-to-face element in a family-owned business. We're not removed. We are making decisions in a closer community. These people are interacting with our own community. And so you're going to run into people face-to-face, and you want to be sure that you've been responsible I think a family has a great deal of sense of responsibility for its community and its the well-being.
Perhaps we can get some of the audience questions if they've been collected passed up here. But while that's happening, I wonder if each of you could ask the other a question that you'd be curious to get their point of view on.
Oh, there you go. You want to go first?
Sure. So I must say, I have always been curious and never knew how the business of Toms of Maine has done in Colgate's hands.
Well, that's I'm glad you asked that question publicly. I think I can answer it publicly without disclosing things I shouldn't. Colgate feels as if they have an absolute gem. Gem is the only word to describe how they feel about Toms of Maine. They have moved things around just to do everything they can for product development, for leverage and getting more distribution. I'll give you an example. When we were trying to sell to some of the majors, we would take months to get one SKU in, and that SKU would end up on the bottom. And I would tell people they could find it at Walgreens or wherever, and they say, no, I can't find it at Walgreens. And so I was at a chain drugstore convention, the week after we had sold, and the vice president of this company came up to me and said, you know, that makes total sense, what you've done with Toms of Maine in Colgate's hands. Now that it's in Colgate's hands, we can really do something with Toms of Maine. I thought, well, you know, I would have loved it if you'd done that with me. But I guess we have a very, they're doing very well. It's the fastest growing brand worldwide at Colgate. I'm very proud of what Tom O'Brien has done, what the people have done. Our research people have had the chance to blend in with the research people in New Jersey at Colgate. But Colgate has really nurtured Toms of Maine to be that much more empowered, and the growth rate is fantastic.
Right.
Yeah. Let's see, what was the question?
The question was, what's your question?
Oh, what's my question? I guess you've been as keen on running a business with values as I think I have. And I'd just like to hear you talk about what it feels like to have a set of values and to have that culture ultimately reflect those values, and to have people know that they're buying that brand because it's different. What's that feel like to you to have built, nurtured, and created such a phenomenon?
Boy, you know, in some ways I'm not sure that I could have done anything else. Being sort of a child of the 60s, you know, it never sort of occurred to me to do it any other way. And I must say, as much as I feel that we have done a lot of good things, I'm also always painfully aware of where we have fallen short. You know, one of my reflections after leaving Seventh Generation, or having Seventh Generation decide to leave me, whatever way you want to describe it, you know, was that while we collectively, and certainly the businesses of BBSR and BSR, and you know, had created these pockets of sort of inspiration and good practice,
collectively, we still were challenged by figuring out how to make sure that everyone else was doing what we were doing. So I focused on that. But, I'm not sure that I could live with myself if I at least didn't try to reflect these values. And I guess the last thing that I would say, which I really wonder about and I struggle about, is how we as a society seem to so often lose a sense of any kind of moral compass. I mean, it's almost like it's a bad thing to talk about morality and ethics in business and in society. And I really worry that we live in a society where we do what's legal, even if it's wrong, and we feel often that if it's legal, it's okay. That's a poor answer to your question, but
while we're reading newspapers day in and day out, or getting the news day in and day out, it's a puzzling, challenging world. But what's also true is that the 25-year-olds and the 30-year-olds that are starting businesses, Jeffrey, are looking at the examples that we have set. And we are very important to them. And to see the degree of growth and entrepreneurship locally that's all about the same kind of values that we espoused, we paved the way for them.
Yeah.
And that's something that we can be proud of.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really saw that when I was teaching. I mean, it was one of the most fulfilling parts of being a teacher is to see all of these, you know, social entrepreneurship is the coolest thing that you can be doing. So that's a good thing. We made good business cool.
Well, let's turn to some of our audience questions. What advice would you give to someone who wants to transition into the business of sustainability? Do you recommend MBA programs?
Well, I'll jump in. I think an MBA program is going to be helpful for you to understand how a business works. And I think the tools and lessons that you learn at business school can be very valuable in one's career as a business person. On the other hand, entrepreneurship is really not teachable. It's more where do you find your models and what can you learn from those. It's very hard to teach entrepreneurship. And the reason is that someone who wants to start a business can go around and ask a lot of people what they think and can try to get some money from a lot of different people. But at the end of the day, if you think it's a good idea and you've got to do it, you're going to do it. And you're probably walking off a plank into, you know, a vast void. But the fact is, there are lots of people out there to help you, that want to help you because you've had the courage to take the risk. I call them angels. I've had many angels in my life who have saved me, so to speak, or come to help me, so to speak. And I had to be willing to listen. I had to have an openness, enough openness to be willing to listen. But the passion and energy that an entrepreneur has is endless. It's simply amazing. And when you create a culture that is of that same way because you've shared the values, you've shared the vision, you've passed on the goals, and you've got people with the skills to do it, it's really quite a force. Now, I think you have to learn by doing in these cases. But I think ultimately people like Jeffrey and I come to a need for some basic practices, some basic ways of operating a place with a lot of people and a lot of aspirations and a lot of energy that needs to be channeled to very specific goals, very specific values. You have to have evaluations that motivate, and you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to focusing and driving the business efficiently. All of those things you learn in a business school, and you learn them by doing, just out of necessity.
But Tom, in the middle of your career at Tom's, you checked out to go to graduate school, but it wasn't business school. You enrolled in Harvard Divinity School.
Right.
What was that all about?
Well, I think I was, I'd had enough, I had worked with my board of directors to create growth, create profits, new products and so forth, and I found that our interest had become pretty single-mindedly focused on sales growth and profit growth, and that we weren't producing any new products after a few years, and I thought, well, really, we've lost our creativity because we're so focused on the numbers. And so I was confused. Did I want to stay here? What did I want to do with my life? I talked to Kate and some people on my board, and I found that the thing I really wanted to do was study religious philosophy. It was in studying religious philosophy that I would get a sense of my own destiny, and Harvard Divinity School was the right place to me, not to go to become ordained, but to have a great education, a graduate education in religious philosophy, which I did half-time for 4 years while others helped me run the company, and it was a totally life-enhancing experience. I mean, I learned enough in philosophy from other people that I could appropriate into the business, and really, although it was, they were radical ideas at the time, they were smart ideas, and I got them from philosophers. So it was the right way for me to grow professionally by getting more knowledge, and I chose philosophy over business school, and it was totally enhanced. I mean, I've written a couple of books about it. I run my businesses differently as a result, and I lead my life differently as a result. So it was, but I getting to the basic question, I don't think there's anything wrong with an MBA. I think that if we're going to run businesses today that are more humane, more responsive to one another, to or the world that we live in, then those businesses have to have more humane values, and they need to operate with those humane values.
So, Jeffrey, this is probably a common question. What is your advice to somebody who wants to get into sustainable business?
Yeah. You know, I would say that the more traditional a business you want discipline in, the more critical an MBA is. To sustainability in a business is not an easy thing, and I think you need the training and the skill set and some of the analytical abilities to make a convincing business case for responsible and sustainable practices. As Tom said, if you want to be, you just got to go do it. I mean, I lasted for a year and a half in college, and sometimes I think that part of my success is that I've just been at it longer than people who stayed in college, then got an MBA. You know, I just had a head start in learning how to run a business.
So you never finished college?
No.
Are you glad your kids didn't follow your lead?
Well, my son tried to, but my wife wouldn't let him. He tried his damnedest to quit college, and my wife was going to kill him if he did.
Okay, can I ask you, I mean, this is interesting. Bill Gates dropped out of college, you dropped out of college. What is the theme here, that we're entrepreneurs of a certain sort, just want to...
There's actually a theory.
Okay.
And it's the 10,000-hour theory, that it takes 10,000 hours of doing anything before you achieve some level of expertise and proficiency. So if you're going to be a business person, you drop out of school to just start your own business, you hit that 10,000-hour mark before everybody who's in college and getting their MBAs. And I think there may be some truth to that, because while I might not be as good with a spreadsheet as someone who finished business school, I think you come out with a lot more common sense and sort of nuts and bolts experience. And again, it's not so much that I think education's wonderful, and I feel like I'm a lifelong learner of my own design. So it's not that I don't believe in learning. I also found in college that the notion that I was going to spend like months writing a paper that someone was going to read and decide whether it was good or bad was like, what's the point of that? You know, if I'm going to spend that much time working on something, I want more impact than the grade that I'm going to get on the paper. It just didn't make sense to me. So, you know, I don't know. My daughter got an MBA. And I'll let you know in a few years whether I think it was a good investment.
So when a Jeffrey Hollander Jr. shows up at Sustain and he says, "Mr. Hollander, you know, I just dropped out of college because I think I just want to come work to you," what's your response to him going to be?
Depends what position the individual is applying for.
Not mailroom clerk.
Yeah. You know, it in some ways, the challenge of a startup is the mixture of people like me who really don't necessarily have great expertise in what they're doing, and the need to mix with someone like me, someone who really does. So it really depends. I mean, I think if they're in a creative role, let's say they're a designer, who cares whether they went to school or not? Their design work speaks for themselves. If they want to be your CFO and they haven't got a CPA or they haven't had any formal financial training, yeah, it's going to give me some pause whether I'm going to hire a financial person who never studied finance. So it does depend a little bit on the path that you want to take. But, you know, I remember my father couldn't believe that he was willing to pay for college and I wasn't going to go. I mean, it was he went to college because he sold hot dogs in the baseball stadium to pay for his college education. And here he was paying for mine. And he used to say to me, you know, you're going to walk into an interview someday and they're going to ask you where you went to college and you're going to be so embarrassed that you have to say I didn't finish. And I told my dad, I never plan on going to a job interview in my life. So far, so good.
Okay. Another question. What kind of innovative financing mechanisms could be established to support triple bottom line businesses to start up and expand? And I know this is a big one and gets to the question of, you know, who you get money from may end up being whose values you have to reflect or project. So talk about innovative financing for socially responsible businesses.
Well, I think there's some actually exciting things happening. I mean, online is a dynamic and powerful way to raise money. And when we raised $3 million to start Sustain, about 600,000 of it came from an online platform called Circle Up. And so the good news is that there is, in some ways, sort of greater democracy in the capital raising world because more people today can participate in it through these online platforms. And this platform, Circle Up, specializes in sort of natural, sustainable, responsible business. And they've raised, you know, tens, if not $100 million so far. So there are new opportunities today that just simply didn't exist before. And I think as the, it has a terrible acronym, the jobs bill begins to manifest itself in the marketplace, we'll see more and more opportunities for people to invest in private companies that aren't just accredited investors. I mean, right now, the big limitation is if you're not an accredited investor, which means if you're not a rich person or relatively rich, a private company like mine can't take your money because the government's trying to protect you from having me lose your money and you not being able to afford losing it. But unfortunately, what that means is that you could afford to invest $100 or $1,000 in a business, but you can't do that in a private company today for the most part. So we have changed a lot of the laws that govern how capital can be raised. And so I would say there's way more opportunities to raise money than there ever were. And it also means that people who aren't already wealthy and successful and have built a network of other wealthy and successful people to raise money from can raise money through online platforms. So it's actually a, you know, I would say in general, if you want to be a responsible, sustainable entrepreneur, now is the best time. I mean, it was a lot more difficult 25, 30 years ago than it is today. And that's really the good news for all these social entrepreneurs. The market's more interested, investors are more available, and, you know, the chances of success are a lot higher.
I would add that what's really important is the vision, the plan, the goal, how you're going to compete. Anyone that's being asked to put money into an enterprise isn't sitting there thinking they're giving a grant to a nonprofit organization. It's not a do-good experience. It's one in which you believe in that person. You believe in that person, and the plan, the vision for the business, and the plan are reasonably interesting to you. That you think there's a chance for success, and you go ahead and feel that, yes, I'd like to be a part of this. So friends, family, fellow investors in other common enterprises, you just have to think about who you know. You know, it really is that simple. First of all, the reason that we all complain that it's hard to get money is that we don't want to go ask for it. I sit on a board of a small apparel company of another, and you know, this woman says, "Well, I don't want to go groveling around asking for money." Well, close it up then. That's part of the job.
Yeah, although I would say, you know, I have advised a young black man who has a business in Harlem. The people he knows, you know, might be able to give him $5 or $10, but they're not going to be able to give him enough money to start his business.
And I was going there.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about these online platforms is that they allow people like him to access capital.
Right.
Where, you know, I mean, I grew up in an affluent environment. I could ask my dentist, I could ask my doctor, I could ask all my parents' friends for money, which doesn't work for people that come from a very low income
background. Correct. And also the laws are being changed of the minimum for an IPO. A guy named Bill Hembrick has been working with Congress to change how big you can have, how small you are to do a public offering. So there are lots of other avenues opening up. But I do think that this question is often because we don't want to ask for money. We want to think that there's some kind of mechanism out there that we have just haven't heard of. But that's not it. It's all about researching what's out there, what's possible, and putting yourself on the line and asking someone for money and knowing that you might fail. And you're asking for someone's money that they might lose. How about that? And they're saying, well, what do you think? We got a pretty good chance of this succeeding? And you say, oh, yeah.
How do you create a business that sells to the masses that is a conscious, organic, made-in-America business?
Well, we have an example of organic apparel here in this country. The United States cannot make, you cannot make an organic product from scratch in the United States. Now, you've probably heard of organic cotton, and you probably wear some organic product. But there is no way with organic cotton, organic or wool, with cotton or wool, that that can be done exclusively in this country at the present time. The reason is organic is a technical term, it's a legal claim, and that it has credentials that people in the United States are not set up to perform. So if I want an organic cotton, I can buy Pima cotton from California that's treated very well, that is a sustainably raised cotton, or a wool from a ranch in the West. If that ranch has set aside a piece of land just to raise organic wool and the rest of his ranch is a commodity, everything you do along the way in the production process requires separate and specialized treatment that this is organic, that the step we're taking to wash the wool, spin the wool, dye the wool, weave the wool, cut and sew the wool, if those operations aren't separated out from the commodity approach, you can't claim it. It will not get passed by credentialing groups as organic. We have to send our cotton to Europe to have it treated so that we bring it back and create organic wool, cotton. I'm in the process of establishing an organic wool fabric. I can't get that entirely in the United States, even though the ranch will have cooperated with me on the sheep, the scouring, the knitting, and so forth has been done in the United States. But I have to have that product treated in such a way that it won't shrink. And the only place that I can go is Europe for that process. So I have to ship yarn to Europe and get it back and then fabricate the fabric as organic. So, it's organic is technical in the apparel business, and it's very difficult to operate. The United States is not friendly to the concept of organic.
Let me, for Jeffrey, to rephrase that a little. I think one of the questioner was getting to that point of asking, you know, how do you establish a niche? So you say you want to sell sustained condoms at the same price as mass market condoms.
You need big gross margins.
What's that?
Big gross margins. So if you're in a business like condoms or vitamins or some personal care products, not all of them, that have big gross margins, you can, by working on a smaller margin from a profit perspective, accommodate some of those additional costs. And You know, I mean, if we, if you buy a condom, three condoms in a drugstore, you might pay $5.95 or $7.95. The gross margin that the manufacturer and the retailer are making are 70% to 80%. They're huge. And so I can afford the additional costs of fair trade or Forest Stewardship Council certified. I can afford those additional costs of being good because the margins are so big. That is really hard to do if you're in a low margin business like diapers or toilet paper or laundry detergent. And one of the reasons that I chose condoms is in part because the margins were so big. They would afford me the ability to do the good things I wanted to do without necessarily having to have the consumer pay for them.
So a last question here. You alluded to the all-important word of failure. So can each of you talk about a failure that you have had and what you learned from it and what others can learn from it? Jeffrey, you seem to be nodding vigorously. So we'll let you start.
One of my favorite talks is my 10 biggest mistakes, and I put a price tag on each one of them. You know, I've made some gigantically big mistakes financially. You know, one could argue that my most recent mistake at Seventh Generation was the biggest, but I've already talked about that. So some of the people know this story, but when Bill Clinton was running for president for the first time, you know, we had Seventh Generation, and we had this environmental catalog, and so we thought we would just really get our consumers excited by endorsing Bill Clinton for president on the cover of our mail order catalog. Instead of having toilet paper or something else on the cover, we figured, you know, this would, like, people will be really excited that we're taking such a aggressive, forthright stance. And Bill Clinton liked it. I mean, he had it in his airplane,
really?
Blown up on his, you know, inside of his airplane. But the truth was that it was a huge mistake for a variety of reasons. First of all, people didn't want the company they bought toilet paper from to tell them who to vote for, regardless of what kind of toilet paper they were buying. We had not built a relationship with our customers as a expert on political matters. We were known for expensive, scratchy toilet paper and laundry detergent that didn't work particularly well. And we're not qualified to dispense political advice. So we calculated that we lost $500,000 in sales as a result of doing that. And that's, you know, that's one of my more expensive mistakes. But, you know, the truth is, and what's interesting about the question, and it's unfortunate that this tradition has lost its way. When Seventh Generation started, in our staff meeting every week, we used to give an award to the person who made the biggest mistake every week. They would get a free dinner at some restaurant. And the reason we did that was because the worst thing you can do is hide your mistakes. Because if you're hiding your mistake, no one can learn from it. Often it's a symptom of some larger problem that isn't getting dealt with. And so this was a way to create a culture where mistakes were out in the open and they were celebrated. And I think that one of the most important, challenging, but wonderful parts of business is about the culture that you create and the way in which you celebrate that culture and the traditions that you create within a company that embody those values and that culture. Anyway, I often won the award.
You know, if you had offered toilet paper with the image of Bill Clinton or the... Did you ever think that might have been...
If we were on the other side of the equation.
Would have sold really well.
We did have toilet paper when we were on this campaign to get people to stop bleaching paper with chlorine. We did have toilet paper with facts about chlorine to scare the shit out of you. And that was very popular.
Well, there's always the condom catalog still. You can try.
We can try. Yeah. And I should say,
with the theme somewhere, of if you feel like you're getting screwed, or you
know. Well, see, this is why the condom business is so much fun. Because, anyway, somewhere here are a whole bunch of condoms I brought for anyone that wants to try them out and let us know how they work. They have
feedback,
been tested.
Consumer feedback, that's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, yeah.
I did an all or nothing decision about working with natural dyes. You know, our apparel is sustainable apparel, so I want not only natural fibers, but I want the dyes to be natural. So I built a $500,000 dye house in the town next to us, and we worked with indigo and all kinds of dyes. And boy, we just kept messing up, you know. We kept turning garments that were cut to be extra large and they come out small. We had streaks, we had holes. We kept at it, and you know, it went on for months and months and months, and we kept on creating probably more damaged goods than the finished goods that were acceptable to sell. So everyone was really after me, you know. This part of the business plan isn't working. So I decided we needed to switch to synthetic dyes just to save the business. We did not know how to handle natural dyes properly. So I liquidated the... I sold off all the equipment, most of the equipment, closed the factory, the dye house, and... we switched over to synthetic dyes that could be done for us by third-party people. However, I didn't drop the question of natural dyes and continued to research how it could be done. And I was able ultimately to learn that we could do it properly, and we have learned to do it properly, and now we've gone on to get a patent application for dyeing the fabric in its full fabric state with natural dyes, and dyeing the yarn in the yarn stage. So we have two patent pending approaches, but it took letting someone go off on the side, the right people to keep on working at it. It cost money, but I wasn't messing up the everyday business. So it was a tough pill, but I didn't lose my values. Ultimately, I kept at it, and now we're bringing it back. So.
Okay. Well, Lisa, I think you had some closing comments, but thanks so much for your questions and your
thank you, David.